This is Arts Alive, the podcast of the St. Pete Catalyst. I'm Bill DeYoung. Welcome. Culver Casson is our guest today. She is a voice artist. She's a singer. She's an actor. She's also a voice teacher and has a wonderful story to tell. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here, Bill.
I'm going to pry this wonderful story out of you. That's what we do here. You're currently in Weird in St. Pete, which American Stage is producing at the Duncan McClellan Gallery. And I wanted to, rather than me try to explain it to people, I was going to put the onus on you. Yep. Tell us what this show is and what happens and why it's there.
Well, that's an interesting question. I believe the reason that it is there this year is because whereas we did it at Floridorama last year, which was an interactive experience for audiences to see Floridorama and meet the weird characters that Helen Murray wrote about in Weird in St. Pete, the Duncan McClellan Gallery offers a different interactive experience for people. I believe the characters feel like they're more at home there. They kind of come to life in their own designated spaces that have kind of been brought to life with props and it's just a little bit more lively, I think, this year, an interactive experience.
I saw it a couple of days ago, and I really liked the idea that everybody kind of had their own atmosphere, environment. You know, Big Bill the Alligator, who's Edward, who's someone I know. And I knew everybody except for you. You're the only person I didn't know. And I'm trying to, like, get Steven's attention and trying to make Jay laugh and, all that sort of stuff. But tell the folks at home, if you will, what happens during this show. Again, rather than me try to explain it and messing it all up. Yeah.
This is a very different kind of experience, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So Helen Murray had this idea to write about the characters of St. Pete, the quote-unquote weird characters of St. Pete that were once alive, that were once here.
See, all the weird characters that work at the St. Pete Catalyst are still alive, so you can't do that. Okay, I'm sorry, stop. So tell us who these people are and what happens.
Right, well, as the audience walks in, they're greeted by Duncan McClellan himself, who is played by two separate characters, two separate actors, Johnny O'Brien and Sarah Beth Seho. And
I got Sarah the other night.
You got Sarah. Sarah Beth. And we do this show every half hour. So as an audience comes in for a 6 o'clock, they'd get one Duncan McClellan ushering them in. And if they come in at 6:30, they get the next. This keeps the audience moving through the whole experience.
Oh, it's kind of like Disney World or something, or like a haunted house.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
You're in,
exactly. So they walk through, and then the characters are they're in their designated areas, and they each kind of tell their own story. So the first one is Mary Reeser, the incinerating woman of St. Pete, and that's who I play.
Oh, tell this story. I mean, this is something I do a series called Vintage St. Pete. I've been writing this for 5 years now, and the story of Mary Reeser is very high on the list of things I want to do next. Can you explain very briefly, not to give anything away, but who she was?
Well, this is the first documented case of,
spontaneous combustion.
That's recorded. So,
okay, that's as much as I know right
Mary.
There.
Yeah, and according to lore, you know, she smoked a cigarette one night and just like,
that was a hell of a cigarette.
Only thing, what a hell of a smoke. But all that was left, really, if you look at photographs, was the back of her chair has kind of this burnt on back of a nightgown, and then there's a foot in a slipper, and that's the only thing left. We don't do anything like that in the show. It doesn't happen live.
But so you play Mary Reeser, though.
So,
in other words, when the audience walks through interactively, as it were, you tell them your story.
Yes. Helen has kind of crafted monologues for each of these characters.
Yeah.
That's kind of based on her imagination and based on the events that these characters are about. And Mary Reeser, a nice 1950s housewife, this happened to. She's crafted this beautiful, beautiful story and Mary's feelings about what happened to her. We don't know if this is true, but Mary has a tale to tell. And it's really kind of, I feel like the audiences, when I do it, they really get into it.
Yeah, I thought it was cool.
Yeah.
I turned down the fireball or whatever you're passing
out. Right, yeah, the atomic fireballs, yes.
Because exactly. I would choke and fall down and the limelight would not be on you anymore.
Right. So,
yeah, I thought it was really well done. And I mean, because nobody really knows that much about her. And Helen was able to put this whole thing together.
Yes. And then we go to visit with Old Bill, the alligator.
Yeah, he's like a 15-foot alligator. Who is a real guy.
Right, the beat poet. We meet Peter Demenz. And it's interesting because we call it Demons Landing.
But
the a correct pronunciation apparently is Demens.
Really?
And, yeah, okay. Peter Demens. And he is the Russian who founded St. Pete.
Right.
And so we meet him and he's wonderful, played by Stephen Riordan.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then we meet, oh, Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
You know, he's a staple of St. Pete.
And that's Jay Hoffa. I thought all the little vignettes, if we can call them that, were very cool.
That's a great way to put it. And then the last one is Cora, who is Cornelius, the mystery monkey of Tampa Bay's wife.
That's Mackenzie.
I think, Mackenzie,
if you're listening, you were born to play that part. Mackenzie's so good. I've seen her in a whole lot of stuff. She's like one of the new young rising talents of St. Pete. You were talking about how it's different here than it was in Floridorama in 24. You like it better? I mean, can you say that?
We can say whatever we want.
Well, I guess so.
But, you know, I personally, I feel more at home in this space at Duncan McLellan.
Yeah.
They've got the chair. They've got the props. We've got a little bit more interaction, and the audience is able to actually sit. And so, for Mary, at least.
Yeah.
And so I get a little bit more attention paid to me. And whereas Floridorama is a beautiful, incredible experience. And if you haven't been, please go visit. It's wonderful to have for a couple of hours. But it was a little, may I say, a little distracting because there was so much to look at for the audience. And experience was overwhelming, right? So,
well, one of the things that I was thinking about, and Duncan came out and said hello to me the other night, the actual Duncan, which I thought was very cool. Duncan and Irene are lovely people. And one of the things that I was thinking about when this was announced was, they're going to do it in the, you know, oh, crowds moving through, crash, bang, you know, but it really, there's grounds in this place. It's really an expansive thing. So you're not really in among the glass art.
No. You have the indoor space primarily for the glass, and the outdoor, you're interacting with the actors. And there's an occasional beautiful glass piece that you'll encounter on a pedestal.
Oh, sure. And Sarah Beth, of course, said, you know, don't break anything.
That's right. We're all breakable. That's right. Yes.
Your dad was Mel Kasson.
Yes.
Yeah. And I don't suppose you know, because nobody knows, because this is National Newspaper Week. And I thought, well, how ironic. Mel Kasson was a very famous newspaper cartoonist for many, many years. I think I knew Red Eye because my grandmother here in St. Petersburg was from Chicago and would buy the Tribune every Sunday. And I saw Red Eye and I went, wait, I know this one. And I recognized his style from some of the earlier stuff, too. You grew up in Westport, Connecticut with this famous cartoonist father, and your mom was an opera singer. Her name was Mary Lee Culver. Is Culver, your name being Culver, is that because it's a family name?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. What was it like to have a famous cartoonist as a dad?
Well, it's kind of interesting that you should say that, because when the cartoonists kind of left New York in the late 60s and the early 70s looking for a place that they could raise their families away from New York, but close enough that they could get there rather easily. So they went to outside the city, and they found these little enclaves. And one of them was this little town in Connecticut called Westport. And it turned into this artist community. And yes, and so a lot of artists were there, lots and lots. So I grew up with Mort Walker, you know, Beetle Bailey, you know, and Leonard Starr, Charles Schulz was my Uncle Sparky. These people were fixtures at my house. The cartoonists would hang out together.
How cool is that?
Yes, they'd all congregate. They'd all drink a little bit and have some fun. And then...
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it was of the time, you know? I mean, and they were such fun people. You know, they really had stories. And they were all... My dad was a little bit older, of course, when I was born. And his mentor was Milton Caniff of Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon. And so he was my dad's kind of like... He took my dad under his wing. And so my dad became the fixture for a lot of younger cartoonists.
Well, that's cool. You took after your mom, though. You went into theater and music.
Yeah, I wasn't quite the artist as my dad. I don't think I'm not quite as developed.
An artist in a different way, Culver.
Yes,
that's what
it is. Different, more internally.
Yeah.
I always kid, like, if I had become like a rocket scientist, my parents would not have known what to do with me, right? No. So, my mom just kind of thrust me on... stage, just said, sing this duet with me. Okay, do this. Mm. And I didn't know any better, so I would go ahead and do it.
Did you enjoy it as a kid?
Yeah, I loved it. I played Hannigan, Miss Hannigan and Annie just this last year at the mm-hmm. Carolwood Players.
Okay.
And I tell the story, when I was 12 years old, my mom, who knew Charles Strauss, got the house seats for Annie one performance when Shelley Bruce was Annie.
Wow.
And so there I was at my 12th birthday, sitting in the audience, and my mother turned to me during intermission, and she said, my face was like dark with fury, and she said, are you not enjoying the show, Culver? And she said, I turned to her, and I said, why didn't you tell me there were auditions? And that, she knew, was like the end, like the bug had been bitten, and that was it.
Yeah.
Like, from then on, it was like, I took voice lessons at Juilliard in high school. Mm-hmm. I would go into the city on Saturday.
You were still
mornings.
In high school when you went to Juilliard. Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I started there, uh-huh. yeah, because I really, I knew that there was another world out there, because wow. my parents had educated me.
Sure.
You know, we'd gone to the new, my parents did everything. I'm an only child, so they took me everywhere, did all the art stuff yeah. with me. I grew up kind of a young adult in a little kid's body, so I couldn't, you know, help it. So I've kind of been that person my whole life, but I do believe the most important thing I can leave this planet with is keeping the arts alive. That's it.
Oh, yeah. That's the name of this podcast. Here we go. So let's wave that flag.
Yeah.
Let me stop, though. You went to Juilliard. You studied opera?
Yeah. I studied on Saturday mornings when I was in high school with Lorraine Newbar. And then I went to Northwestern University. Mm-hmm. I studied with Elizabeth Fisher. And I studied opera there. There wasn't a musical theater program when I was there. Now there is. So we were bridging the gap between the musical theater and the opera program.
Oh, yeah.
So we did everything. A bunch of us did everything, which was wonderful. And then after that, I did work. I sang in Chicago for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then I auditioned for Juilliard and I got in. And then I became an honorary member of the Juilliard Opera Center program,
wow.
which was really a great experience.
That's very cool.
Got to study with all these incredible, incredible teachers, have these wonderful experiences, which set me up for the fact that I didn't want to sing opera.
Well, you know, I think there's a very thin line. I mean, it's not an original thought between opera and musical theater. Do you know who Deborah Voigt is, the great opera singer?
Yeah.
She has, when I lived in, briefly, around Vero Beach, she bought a house there. And I actually got to know her a little bit as the local journalist guy. And she was the first opera singer, though not the last by any means, to tell me that she started musical theater. And some voice teacher said to her, you know, I think you can do this. You want to try going to this level? And that's when she discovered opera. Somebody heard it in her voice. But they're not that dissimilar. And you find so much of that. You know, I've done a lot of work with St. Pete Opera and talked to a lot of singers. And so many of them do both, still do both. What did you want?
Yeah. When I was growing up, what did I really want?
Yeah.
What did I want? I just wanted to be on stage. I wanted to perform. That was it. I just couldn't wait. That was like that. That was the thing. Whatever it was.
Yeah.
I dabbled in broadcast journalism for a while before I thought about maybe doing that.
Oh yeah.
But it was really singing. That was singing and acting. That was really what I wanted to do when I was growing up. That was what floated my boat.
So you never had somebody, parents or your mom or somebody sing, get a real job, this will never work.
No, I wouldn't have belonged to that family much longer.
Yeah, because, you know, you do hear a lot of that, too. And sometimes people, like even professionals like pop singers or Americana people will say, I was the world's greatest mandolin player, but my parents said, you know, you're never going to make a living. Go to college. And they say, well, I did. I went and got a business degree or something.
Right, but and are you happy? Right, are you happy?
Well, yeah, and then they still have the business degree, but they're playing every night somewhere.
Exactly. Well, mine was lucky. My high school had this great program. It wasn't an arts high school, but and it's still a fantastic high school, Staples mm-hmm. High School in Westport. And we studied Stanislavski for 3 years.
Wow.
So I was in 36 productions. We just really...
In high school?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah, we really just... Because we were an hour from New York, so we had the funding, we had the interest, and we had all the artists in the community that wanted to contribute. So,
oh, that's fantastic. I wish we could say that around here. We've got a lot of great, talented people, a lot of people with drive and desire and you know, ambition and everything. We just don't have the money. What brought you to St. Pete?
Well, what brought me to St. Pete originally was my health. It wasn't doing that well, and I went somewhere and I got better.
Good.
But, thank you. But then we decided to stay because I found this private school and I was teaching at this private school, acting and music, mm-hmm. and I had all this autonomy and I was able to direct Pippin and It's a Wonderful Life at the Philheimer Capital Theater, and I had all this wonderful experience, and I couldn't turn it down when I found St. Pete and I found the arts, and it just seemed like this vibrant, wonderful gem. And I just couldn't, this was a secret thing that I just didn't want to leave.
But you felt accepted, though.
Totally.
And so you can, I'm from New York. I'm from Westport, Connecticut. I got a degree from Juilliard Northwestern. Can I do something here? I mean, you were accepted fairly
Yes,
quickly.
I auditioned for American Stages for their improv program.
You were in that.
Yes,
oh, yes, that's right.
Program.
Yes.
And then, so I graduated from that, and then I became a member of Definitely Not Murderers, which was American Stage's musical improv team. So we did that.
Yeah.
And so I was around American Stage for a while, so I got to know a version of the administration. Mm-hmm. And it's changed a little since then, but then Anthony Gervais, who I just absolutely adore.
Oh, yeah, he's a friend of mine.
Yes,
he's a great guy.
I just adore him. And, he brought me into the folds for the Beyond the Bay Repertoire Company, and then I did the 10 Ways to Survive the Zombie Apocalypse at Boyd Hill. I was in that show.
Oh, sure.
There too, so.
The only one I didn't see.
Oh, okay.
The Boyd Hill shows, of course. You're a teacher. You
yes.
do voice lessons.
Yes, I have.
Let's
my own
talk
studio.
About. Let's
yes.
get you some. Let's
oh,
plug
okay,
that
sure,
for you.
Plug.
Come on.
Right. Yeah. Culver
yeah.
Note. It's Culver Note Voice Studio and or culvercasson.com.
Okay.
And right now, I'm actually helping the students prepare for Thespians for the musical theater competition at Plant High School. So,
wow.
What you were saying before, how musical theater and opera they do go hand in hand,
sure.
because the technique is the same. You really have. It's all about the breath support, and it's about getting that voice up and out so that it can be heard over an orchestra. I mean, yes, we have microphones, but they're not magic. So you need to put the voice in the right placement in the head and have it shoot out in the right place. And that's pretty much it. That's what I teach, just bel canto, good singing. And that is exactly where most of the good voice teachers that I know in New York teach the same variety of singing to opera, legitimate musical theater singers. We all kind of have the same technique. Singing and speech operate from the same place. So some of the successes of my students have been, one of my students was Lavender in Matilda at the Patel. Another student was the lead in Kinky Boots. Another one of my students right now is Judd in Oklahoma. And then we have one who is in Company. I have a bunch of students who are very successful and doing really well in the Tampa Bay area.
That's brilliant.
Yes.
That's brilliant. So, how long have you been here? It's a couple of years?
Only
eight or nine.
8 or 9 years.
Okay.
Yeah. I know. It's taking a little while to get yourself kind of out there.
Well, speaking of Company, you still do you pop up in community theater sometimes.
Yes.
And you just did Company with
the Carolwood Players.
Oh, yes. See, I haven't been over to Carolwood, and those guys do a lot of really interesting stuff. And
yes, and the talent, though, that's the thing. You don't realize all these incredibly talented people who live in this area, and they're looking for work, and then they show up at these auditions, and you're like, I can't believe all these people are in this show. It's like a professional level thing. And here we are doing it for the labor of love. But the audiences, I mean, the reviews and just the raves that we've gotten are just incredible.
Stephen Sondheim is impossibly hard. I mean,
yes.
I'm sorry. You know, I watched them, and I really liked A Little Night Music that SBO did.
And when St. Pete Opera did it, wasn't it incredible?
That's what I was saying. I thought it was great. Yeah. You know, it's polysyllabic. It's, but didn't you say somewhere that was sort of a dream role for you?
You know, it's funny. All of Sondheim's roles are kind of dream roles, but you have to reach a certain age to play some of them too, you know,
sure.
Young high schoolers playing Mrs. Lovett. Yay. But like, you know, you have to grow into those parts.
And I've seen one or two of those.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, okay.
As talented
as
you are, you know, you're just not. So
17 year old Sweeney Todd. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Not quite. But so Joanne has to reach a certain life experience. Right?
Because that's what the character's about.
Yes.
Yeah.
And not that we have to be, you know, all about the method acting or all that, the techniques and all that, but there is something, there's gravity to her. And there's something about having that. And I'm from New York, and I did grow up in the late 70s, early 80s, but like that era, I know. And I'm familiar with the way those women were and the way the women acted. And it was just something that And the music, oh my gosh. It felt like I felt like I was in an episode of Charlie's Angels or like the Love Boat part of it. But that music from the 70s is such iconic stuff. And but the song of the Ladies Who Lunch is one of those parts that
I forgot that was from Company.
Right.
Yeah.
You just want to wrap your vocal cords around that. So
Tell me other dream roles, things that you'd like to still do.
Well, Mrs. Lovett is definitely a dream role for me, that's for sure. And I'm too old now, but Amalia in She Loves Me. If they would do a production of that for like us people in a little bit on the older midlife, it still could be done. I think it could be. It's just a romantic love story. I've done one of my lead fantasy roles was Rosabella in Most Happy Fella already, which was an incredible part. Yeah. And there are some opera roles that were dream roles that I've already done too.
Do you still do opera? I mean,
did some in St. Pete opera a couple of years ago. A great composer in the area is Tom Sivak.
Oh, I know Tom.
You know, Tom. Sure. And so I did his opera Tika Tika with St. Pete Opera there too, which is a small little opera about two little birds.
This was probably right before I moved back here.
Oh.
I don't remember that at all.
Okay, yeah.
Tom's great.
Yes, he's fantastic. I've done a bunch of his things too.
Yeah,
yes.
So let's recap a little bit. Weird in St. Pete is on stage mostly through October, through the end of the month, somewhere
that's right.
In there.
October 19th.
Oh, well, there you go. October 19th, little pre-Halloween for you there. You can get tickets at americanstage.org. And the cool thing about it is that it's every half hour.
That's
you start at 6 or 7 at night, and then you can...
That's right.
Basically, it's like standing in line at Universal Studios. If you miss that one, you get on the next one. You get on the flume ride, and off you go.
That's right.
It is called Weird in St. Pete. Helen R. Murray wrote it. It's at the Duncan McClellan Gallery. Dare I say it again, americanstage.org. Culver Casson, what a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you as well. You as well.